Alright, welcome to this episode of the JRE Review. Podcasts have been scarce. A lot of this is because Joe Rogan is now touring with Dave Chappelle, or at least he was a lot last week, and I know they have more dates to go, so, you know, podcasts are on the back burner, but that's okay. We got a couple to end the week with. Whitney Cummings, the legend of comedy that she is, and then Brian Moses. I'm joined, as always, by my good friend Mark.
Woohoo!
Who... What's up, Mark?
What up? Dude, Joe Rogan and Dave Chappelle, are they coming to LA? Can we get on that?
I don't think that they are.
Bastards.
I'm not sure what they're... Well, they hit Seattle. They hit Oregon. They're kind of, like, in different places. They went to Utah. It's kind of weird they're not doing an LA one, unless I'm just being ridiculous and I haven't seen it. But I don't remember seeing anything for that. How immense is that show? Like, to see those two perform, and then Ian Edwards is opening up for them as well.
Oh, man.
I mean...
I would watch... Dude. I would go to a Dave Chappelle concert if a candle opened up for him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it could just be just a watermelon on stage, just in front of a microphone for an hour, doing nothing. I'd be like, this is...
You have to watch it. Completely burn out.
Completely.
Before Dave comes on.
I would do it. I'd pay a lot of money to do it, too.
A candle, then some paint drying, and then Chappelle. Still the best show you've ever seen.
Ever.
Yeah, still the best show. I would love to see what his new material is. I assume he's building up to another one of those Netflix specials, which are brilliant. I mean, he's raising the bar in what those specials are, for sure.
Oh, he is. I mean... Dude, I went and had lunch with my brother, and I was quoting some of his bits, and my brother was just dying. I was like, dude, you have to watch his Netflix specials. They're so good. He's like, I'm going to. I'm like, you don't even realize. And we were talking about how we really grew up with stand-up comedy. Like, our parents watched stand-up like crazy. Like, it was a very big thing in our house. Like, Sunday nights, Fox always had Sunday night, like, comedy on. Hosted usually by an old comic named Wayne Cotter, who's still a favorite of mine. He doesn't even tour anymore. He just does corporate gigs. I looked him up like a month ago. And I was like, this dude was so damn funny. He always cracked me up. I miss him. I really do. But he would host this show on Fox Sunday nights, and it was great. It was a bunch of up-and-coming comics. You know, back then, this was 20 years ago. This was when this – 30 years ago. It's like around this time The Simpsons premiered and things like that. Married with Children was still on the air, stuff like that.
Wow.
So, and like stand-up specials, like everything. Our parents just inundated it with us, and they loved comedy. That and then like Mel Brooks movies, Airplane, comedies like that. That was our house, just nonstop laughter because of comedy. So, but yeah, that's all I have.
Do you think that was a big reason why you got into stand-up?
Huge. I also think it's one of the reasons I probably had a better handle on stand-up when I first started out than a lot of comics. First of all, I started when I was much older. So I think, you know, but it's hard to – there are funny comics in their 20s, no doubt. But a lot of comics will tell you they didn't really feel like they became a true stand-up comic until they were much older because you've – done some shit, you've lived through some shit, you've experienced things, you have age and wisdom combined to inform your perspective on the world, your views on life, and let's face it, comedy is just an extension of those things. So, but I feel like
people aren't taking people in their 20s all that seriously. Unless you're that age as well. When it comes to stand-up,
right,
you're reflecting on things that you've seen and experienced, and you're trying to do it with a little bit of authority.
Exactly.
In a sense, even if you're a silly comedian, you've got to be like, I've been there, I've done that. That's why you get that streak of comedians that are like 40 to 50, slightly onwards, and they're talking about family, they're talking about jobs, you know, they can just talk about everything, but they look like dads.
Right, they do.
Nowhere else does that work. That doesn't work on, like, in the movies or on TV or, you know, I mean, SNL. SNL is made up of 40-year-olds.
Yeah, it feels like it, doesn't it? It feels like it.
Sometimes.
So,
but
I mean,
you know,
obviously, there
just is that.
There are going to be exceptions. A funny young comic you and I have worked with named Dave. black kid, and I think he comes from Missouri, and I think he's funny. He's got funny jokes, but he also comes from a unique perspective of being an African American growing up in a mostly, you know, white neighborhood, and he's had different experiences with that, and I think he brings those experiences to his comedy, and he has something to say on it because he lived it his entire life. So even though he's still young and ridiculously more handsome than either of us combined, you know, he's got something to say because of the circumstances of his life. And I think that informs a lot of comedy. But, you know, things weren't – I mean, I had a normal childhood, some parts shitty, some parts great. So it took some age for me to get a real perspective on things, I think. But my parents showing comedy to us so often, I think, really helped me understand, like, what funny is, how to tell a joke. You know, just the rhyme and the meter and the rhythm of joke telling. I learned that from, I feel like, watching stand-up and from Mel Brooks movies, because that dude's the funniest dude on the planet.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you are right about Dave. I mean, it does help to have had a lot of crazy experiences.
It does.
And you can squeeze them in earlier, for sure, because you just find a voice for
absolutely.
It. It's that therapy that allows you to kind of get through it. But even that being said, I mean, what is the peak, right?
True.
Because it's a combination of how good your comedy is,
mm-hmm.
but also where your reputation is. Like,
exactly.
Who knows who you are, who's following you. And it's kind of a beautiful journey to know, unlike being an actor, whereas, you know, a lot of times you got to be good looking to be an actor,
mm-hmm.
or you got to have a look that works.
A look.
That shit's going to fade. So you got to get in. With comedy, it's like, just look like something and continue to improve. And these guys are peaking. Like, Chappelle and Rogan are in their 50s.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. Maybe Chappelle
may be
like
in his late 40s. But, I mean, he's...
Yeah, you might be right.
Because he's a couple of years older than me, I think. Let's see. Chappelle's show came out when I just graduated college, I believe. So,
yeah,
he's probably
about
10 years older than me, maybe. So...
Oh, okay.
Maybe
either way, he's close, right?
Maybe less.
And over the next 10 years,
yeah,
he's going to be able to really bank on this.
Absolutely.
So it's purely the experience portion
mm-hmm.
of this skill set that we go for.
Yeah. I mean, it's important. It's important.
It still gives us a chance, is what I'm saying.
I mean, I did a show.
We got time.
We've gone from no chance to slim chance.
Slim to none, but some.
But I was doing a show. Okay. I was doing a show with a bunch of young comics a couple of weeks ago, and funny guys. I mean, they can tell a joke, but a lot of it was about hand jobs. And I was like, you know, hand jobs, not that funny to me anymore. Like, it's just like, how many different ways can you go about hand jobs? You know, this guy was like, this one guy was talking about, he's like, all right, so I'm going to give you the top 3 hand jobs I've ever had in my life. And I was like, oh boy, here we go. Okay. Now this will be interesting. Because it's like, I don't know, what perspective, and he didn't really have a perspective on it. He didn't really, he just kind of like listed them. I was like, well, that's, it's like one of those food, like recipes, you want to find a recipe online, and it's just like a food blog, and they just tell you about the time that, you know, their mother made this for them. You're like, just give me the fucking recipe. That's kind of how I felt about that set. I was like, oh, just don't list your favorite hand jobs. Just get to the nitty gritty. Anyway.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, that's the thing with the different audiences.
True.
There'd just be certain ones that will want more, will want that unique perspective. And when the comic doesn't deliver it, you're just stood there with people not really laughing as hard as you want,
yeah,
with the energy that you want. So you'll go, oh, there's something missing here. I need to really find out. It's not just the top superficial little bit of laughter. Where's the depth in this part of the joke?
Where's the nitty gritty? Where's the meat? Yeah, as it were.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to find that. And that's the part. And it's like, how do you say it? How is it to you in your voice? That's the shit that always catches me out. I'm like, hold on, how do I say
right.
this?
Right. I think all comics struggle with that, because a lot of times you're like, I'm going to kind of speak how I feel and what I feel like the truth is about this certain thing. But you're like, will this ruffle feathers? Will people agree with me? you know, the classic comedians find the truth in everything, and you can't, and you laugh because you can't help but agree, even though sometimes it's horrible. You're like, oh my God, but that's so funny because he's right or she's right. And it's true. It's true. That's why
you're like, I shouldn't be laughing. I shouldn't be laughing at this.
Well, that's why parenthood is such a popular topic for comics, because it's universal. You know, one comic comes out and says, don't you sometimes just want to murder your children? And all the parents laugh because they're like, hell yeah, I want to murder my children. You know?
And then people in the audience like me that don't have children, I'm like, well, I sometimes want to murder other people's children. So, yeah, I get it. I feel it.
It's true.
I feel that pain.
It's true. Often and always.
Have you had a chance yet to watch Whitney Cummings' new special?
No, our buddy Jay was asking me that the other day. I haven't.
I haven't had a chance to either.
Do you love her?
And
How do you feel about her?
Obviously, before this, I do like a lot of her comedy. I really do.
Okay.
I think she likes to pick on herself for her insecurities.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's like quite neurotic about stuff. She's talked before about. I think she takes beta blockers.
Oh yeah,
for her
that makes
like
sense.
Adrenaline. So she's like a little anxious there. She even talked about having some plastic surgery on this podcast, and you can kind of tell like she's had definitely some Botox. Or
yeah,
something.
I think so. A little work.
You know, so she's working through these kind of anxieties, and it makes sense because she's on a show.
Mm-hmm.
She's famous. People are looking at her. She's pretty, so they're judging her.
They judge her on that immediately.
She's getting into an age where, look, she's not 25 anymore.
Right.
So wrinkles are starting to show, and things are. So there's a ton of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses her comedy to kind of work through it instead of being a female comic that is just talking about vaginas all the time or just trying to, like, gross you out to get some attention.
Right.
I don't know. Sometimes that pops up and it gets tiring. You're like, look, I know you're better than this. So stop saying those things.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm not feeling this. But yeah, she's very clever.
She is
clever. She is incredibly clever, for sure. You can hear it on this podcast. And then, you know, she brings this sex doll to kind of sit with Joe, which was creepy as hell.
Yeah.
I mean, you could see it on two ways to watch this podcast or to listen to it. Obviously, just the audio.
Mm-hmm.
But even Joe says at the beginning, like, watch it. Watch the YouTube. It was horrifying, to be honest. That thing is really creepy. For one, it looks exactly like her.
Right.
Exactly. Its eyes move around. On Joe's Instagram, he has like a real close-up of it, like, responding. The talking's all jinky. Like, it's a mess. It's not sexy. But, I mean, how long until they get those shits perfect?
Oh, man. Not long
10
at all,
years.
Man. Not long at all. I don't know. Will that be better for the world or worse for the world?
I don't know. I mean, or is it going to be neither? Does it have to have such an impact? Do things even have this much of an impact?
I don't know.
To say, look how big YouPorn is. Over the last 10 years, it's like the most downloaded, looked at thing that ever existed.
Right.
Right? And there was all this concern for many, many years before this through religious pressure and whatever, mm-hmm. state to state. There was all this, you know, porn magazines can't be legal and you can't have strip clubs and you can't. There was all this concern that the world would end.
Right.
Well, now a fucking 10-year-old can look at the most depraved shit that
ever.
Ever imagined.
Ever.
Instantly, just as soon as he thinks of it, he can Google it and probably find it. And the world's not getting fucked up.
Right.
It's just existing and continue.
Well,
like, we don't hear stories of all this deprived sexual weirdness.
No, I do think you do have, I mean, at least I've heard it talked about. There's definitely concerns that exposure to porn and things like that at such an early age has a lot of disadvantages for someone's sexuality, like in terms of like expectations for sex and in future relationships. The idea that porn is not real sex, it's for entertainment and stuff. So I feel like, but sometimes I feel like, you know, some of these nerds out there that are just so fucking hostile towards women, I don't know, this might be a kind of a
better relief so they can take their aggression out on a goddamn sex doll and leave the real people alone. You know what I mean? It's like, here, it's like a punch.
Yeah.
You know, it's like their own version of a punching bag. But then at the same time, as I say that, I'm like, yeah, well, then they get a taste for it and
step and stone.
Yeah, type of thing. They escalate. Gateway drug. It's a gateway drug to actually actual Whitney Cummings. It's probably it'll all come out in the wash. We're fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah, will it be that outlaw? I mean, look, like you said, it's only really 10 years that we've had this instant access on the phone.
Yeah.
So that, like, you know, masturbation is out of control. But it's not long enough. It's not a longitudinal enough study to see how people's relationships are developing.
Right.
So that's entirely possible. It could make some, you know, oddly deprived, kind of weird sexual beasts. Right. But it's, look, man, it's the driving force of all existence. If it's not built into our DNA to find a comfortable equilibrium with this, then we don't have a chance, and we've been here a long time.
Yeah.
I'm sure this is not. It's definitely better to have more access than less. I think less doesn't make people better. It doesn't make people treat people better,
right?
Or understand sex and relationships better. I think it just makes us repressed and do fucked up things.
It's true, and repression's bad. I mean, repression. Just an old coach of mine, old acting coach, always used to say, repression leads to deviancy, and I think that I think there's something to that. So I feel like
your acting coach said this.
Well, it was an interesting thing because there was a young lady on stage who had aspirations of being an actress, but she wanted to, but she was very religious, very Christian, and there were certain lines she would not cross, and that is completely her prerogative and more power to her. But it was butt stuff entirely. She's like, I won't do it in the butt. And I was like, well, you're never gonna have a career. No, and he was like, you know, we as artists and we as actors and we as performers and we as human beings, and then specifically you as women, have to define your boundaries. And that's incredibly important, to define your boundaries. I will say though that this is an expressive art form, and somehow he moved into the whole situation. He was like, but repression breeds deviancy. And consider that just for your life, not just for your profession, but for your life. What could possibly happen? You know, if you're repressing some of these things, how will that show up in your life in other places? It was just food for thought. But I thought it was a really, interesting thing. And then you see it in the world a lot. You know, how many stories do we hear about Catholic priests? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's obviously an issue. And Joe brings that shit up a lot, too. Yeah. Sometimes I'm like, damn, Joe. He's just, like, really hammering the church. But fuck it. Why not?
Right.
I mean, they did awful things. And to just let them... so much of that is gone under the rug. And it's almost like it gets talked about a lot now, to where you do it around anyone that's Catholic, they're like, okay, we know the problems. I'm like, hold on. No, that should be important.
Exactly.
You can sit there and tell me how proud you are to go to church. I think someone else should be allowed to sit there and be like, oh, they're also fucked up. You know this, right?
Right.
Do you think about this much? You know, I think it's, mm-hmm, again, easy for them just to not pay attention. What's a non-sexual deviant example that you can think of? Is it like when you say, I'm not going to eat any ice cream this month? And then you just keep thinking about that and you repress it, and then you're like fucking eating all the ice cream.
Could
and cookies.
Be. I mean, and just repression in terms of, like, I mean, it's a damn good question. I wish I had a better answer prepared for it. You know what I mean? But
this isn't a prepared answer.
This
show,
is not.
So don't worry
this
about
is
it.
Not, okay? Folks.
We're reflecting on a podcast conversation that was also not scripted.
That was a lot.
And if we don't have anything for it, then sorry.
Our bad.
Yeah, our bad. What did you think when they were talking about the dueling Nazi scars, right? So on the podcast, mm-hmm, and they talk about how these got, like, the, what was it, Operation Paperclip, where we took all the or the German Nazi rocket engineers, and that's how we built our space program.
Right. Von
Braun and all those guys came over. Well, some of them had these big scars like on their face, and they were officers, and they went to military officer schools, and it was a sign of like strength and pride and all the rest of it that they would duel with these fucking little swords, you know, like fencing.
Right.
And if you had like nasty slices on your face, you were seen as being a man, as a badass. And it was like hot to women. I'm like, those fucking Nazis are crazy.
They're out of their goddamn mind. I mean, I think that's a universal truth, right? Nazis are fucking insane. Yeah, it was this. I mean, they had such weird ideas of what machismo and strength. I mean, the fact that white haired, you know, blonde haired, blue eyed people were the master race and things like that.
I think you have to have these like extreme events and things going on to even build that kind of army. You know, to think that it was just Hitler came along, did like riled them all up with his meth fueled speeches, and all of a sudden everyone's on board to do tons of fucked up shit.
Right. No, exactly. Well, it's a lot like what people will say about, you know, state of politics in our country, that the man in the White House is not the cause but the symptom. I feel like Hitler is kind of the same way. He was a symptom of a mindset that was already in place. He gave people permission to feel the way they felt already, as opposed to, you know, feeling how they should feel fucking bad about things like that, like master race and that. You know, Germans should only be in Germany and things like that, yada, yada, yada. So I feel like they were primed. They were in a mindset, especially after World War One, with their country just absolutely devastated financially, you know, economically. They were in a state of mind to allow this crazy shit, because they were like, well, we're rock bottom, so what are we going to do?
Yeah, they were desperate.
They were desperate.
And they wanted their pride back, because they've been a prideful people.
Yeah.
And now this energy came, and they were angry.
Yeah.
And maybe that's how they get into it. I think it's fascinating often, like, how much this shit does come up on Rogan's podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it is just one of those things in history that's like, wasn't that long ago, and was really fucking bizarre. And
yeah.
People need to understand it as best they can in case it ever popped up again. And I think so much of us just assumes it will never happen again.
Mm.
Like, we've seen it, we know it. But it happened then, and that was like a civilized time.
Yeah.
People had cars. They had electricity. They had similar things. It wasn't the fucking Stone Age. You know, they had governments in place. We had submarines and tanks and bombs. And, I mean, it wasn't a primitive time. And boom, there it was. And there are countries now less developed that are developing.
Yeah.
That are not even in the place the Germans were in the 40s. Mm. And they get guys that come along, and this shit can creep in.
It does. And well,
having these conversations, I think, keeps it in your mind of like, oh, this is shit to watch out for. This behavior is not good.
Well, and you go back to a good point of pride. That that's a fair point. Like, that's what nationalists feed on, the idea of exceptionalism, wherever you are, German exceptionalism, American, blah, 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 you know. And how do we express it? You know, we express it in different ways, you know, economically, in sports. Sometimes you express it in war. Americans love to express their exceptionalism with war because, damn it all, I know you're a naturalized citizen. I've lived here my whole life.
Yeah.
Woo, you love to – anytime France criticizes us once, the go-to answer is, well, if we had come saved your ass in World War II, as if, like, that's it's like for the end of time, they can never say anything bad about us because we like saved their life once. It's like, well, you know, even when we're acting like assholes, but it's
well, it is good to remind the French, though.
That was a poor example. They should be reminded. That was a poor example.
We can remind them for a while. We're keeping working.
Absolutely.
Hard. Maybe what was their sense of humor like? I feel like the Nazis didn't have a great sense of humor.
I don't think so.
I feel like that when your sense of humor is bad, when you can't do... Okay, for example, the roast battle, right?
Uh-huh.
So the next guest that was on Rogan's podcast for the week is Brian Moses. That's episode 1329. Mm-hmm. Now, the same thing. Whitney used to do roasts, and she roast, Joan Rivers. Mm-hmm. And that was hilarious. It's so funny. Like, I can't remember what she said. God, I wish I remember the joke. They said it on the podcast, though. Almost like her vagina had two entrances. One for white people and one for black. Like, that's how old she is. Like, that's a fucking joke. Amazing hilarious joke. Brilliant. And it's funny, too, because Whitney is a sweetheart. Like, she's not like the roaster type person.
Right.
Right? But in the same way, Brian Moses, he's done the roast battles now at the Comedy Store for a long time. Mm-hmm. How long have you been performing at the Comedy Store?
Year and a half.
Year and a half. Okay. Yeah. So he was there before Joe came back. So, and Joe's been back now like 5-6 years.
Right.
And he has this thing where he always makes everyone hug afterwards because it's so brutal. It's so difficult.
Yeah.
Right. And Joe even talks about how squeamish it is for him, even though he's the fucking commentator of the UFC.
Exactly.
But he can't watch the roast sometimes because it's so
brutal. They're so brutal. They are oh, man. It's like the Jeff Ross thing I sent you the other day.
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't care. He doesn't give a shit. He has never felt bad about a joke, I don't think.
No. Well, he's not encouraged to. He makes a living to do it, and people expect it. But it's that beautiful thing about a society. Like, it couldn't be more important to have the roast stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I can't imagine myself ever doing that. I don't know if I would ever go down that road. I think it's very specialized and very hard to do. And shit, I don't know if I would take it too personally. I think you got to be... I don't know what it takes to be a great roaster, but they're always brilliant.
So I wrote, like, a year ago, remember when there's the whole big hubbubaloo about the White House Correspondents' Dinner? And it was what's-her-face, Michelle. She had her own show on Netflix, Red Hair. Talks kind of like this. And, of course, she leveled Trump and the rest of the administration, blah, 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 blah. And, of course, she got...
Oh, yeah, she's on The Daily Show.
God forgive me, I can't remember.
Yeah, she's very funny. I like her a lot. Damn it.
And I was...
We should know these names.
I know, I really should. My brain is not working today. But I started writing my own roast jokes because I was like, I could do this shit. This would be a blast. And some of them I was pretty pleased with. I feel like I could. And I feel like a lot of that comes from as a kid, picked on so much that I've learned to take a joke and I've learned to take, you know, the proverbial punches and whatnot. But I can sure as shit give them out, too. So I think I'd enjoy it, actually. Because I'm like, you know that they're up there to be mean. That's the whole purpose.
Yeah.
So
Well, you know what's cool about it is they do this thing where you actually work in teams, I believe,
uh-huh.
at least when you get to TV. So, like, for example, let's say you were performing, and then we take me, Dave, and, you know, some other comics that we know.
Right.
And they tell you who you're up against, and you get time to write a few jokes.
That's cool.
So, you get, like, 5, I think, jokes to kind of put together and memorize, and then you'll use them maybe in different orders depending on what they throw at you. So there's definitely a practice portion,
right,
that goes with it, and some strategy. Those are the things about it I like, because there's not often a great deal amount of structure in stand-up.
Mm-mm.
And to have it kind of thrown at you that way could be a lot of fun. But I also feel like you could get thrown off so bad that your head would just be spinning.
Huge.
And you'd be like, fuck, I just got raped.
Huge. You could. You absolutely could. You could get destroyed.
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And
I mean,
there's nothing quite like getting on the stage and everyone looking at you and you either being the butt of the joke or feeling like you don't have a joke, and you are just, that is just disappointment. That is like disappointing in a woman in bed times 1,000.
Right.
That is terrible. That's a terrifying prospect.
You don't see many veterans doing it either. Jimmy mm-hmm. Carr likes to do it. That English comedian that has laugh like a donkey.
Mm-hmm.
He loves to do those.
Yep.
He really is into them. But you don't, you know, it's not like you get Chappelle just wandering in and crushing.
No.
Or like the Wayans brothers after all this time.
We kind of like, why
and
would
I
they, you know?
Why a little bit?
Why would they want to do
I think
it?
That... But if it's one of those things where, look, I've done this for so long,
mm-hmm.
I can stay very calm, I'm already good at picking on people.
Right.
Like, it just does seem like there's kind of another level of fear that comes along
absolutely.
With this.
Absolutely. Oh, we're
this is like next level comedy.
We've almost neglected to mention the greatest roaster comic of all time. That's Don Rickles, God rest his soul.
Oh yeah,
he was the greatest. God. Go watch some of those old Dean Martin roasts. Find some clips on YouTube. Mm. Find Rickles. Oh my! Some of his shit was so far over your head. You're like, I don't even know. I'm sure he just obliterated this dude, but I don't know what he said by it. But God, he was so funny. But that's what he did. He was an insult comic always. Like, he picked on the audience. That's what he did. He was amazing.
Yeah, he was absolutely fine and really brutal. Even brutal. Now, you'll hear some and you'll be like, fuck. Knowing how sensitive they were back then, I mean, it just makes it that much more powerful.
Oh man,
I think it's incredibly important.
Yeah,
that this kind of crazy shit happens. I mean, they even compare it a little bit to like those Japanese game shows,
mm-hmm.
in the sense of like it's a really fucked up thing that we like to watch. Like, the roast battles are funny,
right?
But we know someone's getting their feelings are hurt, and then we could imagine someone saying it to someone else and us watching it and being able to get joy out of someone else's
pain,
horrible discomfort.
I know.
And then you take those shows, like those weird Japanese shows where they've, like, you know, they trick someone into thinking their house exploded or their family died and they've just found out and then they've got to react and then everyone laughs at them. Like, those shows are fucked up. They really are.
They are.
They're crazy.
Oh, Japanese shows are always fucked up.
So much pleasure. And that really is, like, the beginning of Fear Factor, which is, you know, Joe's show. I mean, it has to be. Because I remember when that first came on, no one had ever seen anything like
it. No.
I was pretty young, and I was like, this is fucking great and crazy.
Oh, I watched it, and I was like, oh, I'm out. I was like, oh, that dude from News Radio. Yeah, I ain't doing that shit.
Dude, when some of the stuff they would eat, and I'm just like, oh, Jesus.
God,
this is horrific.
Wasn't...
so horrific.
Joe was actually on Chappelle's show when they did the Fear Factor sketch, right? Wasn't that Joe? And Chappelle came on as the cracked
with,
out
what's
there,
his
and he's
name?
Like,
the
yes.
Is it Tyrone or Tyrese?
I think it was something.
Anyway, the cracked out dude.
Because he'd be like, okay, Joe Rogan.
Scratching his neck.
Yes.
And didn't he have to jump to the bottom of something to get some crack?
Yes.
And he's like, I'm in. Yes. Just goes and does it immediately. That's fucking hilarious. Joe showed up a few times on Chappelle's.
That's right.
I think second season was when he showed up being Joe Rogan on Fear Factor. The first season, they were just walking around New York. Dave had like a fake mustache on, and they were handing out stickers for great boobies. That was it. That was
the
whole
skit. That's right.
It was just him and Joe. Joe was like holding the box.
Mm.
And the story behind that I heard is that he just like wandered in. He just was wandering around and bumped into Joe and was like, hey, we're about to film this. You want to come? Joe's like, fuck yeah.
Oh, that's amazing, dude. What a great story.
Dude, what a time to have lived in New York and known all those types of comics that would have been out there.
Right.
And just had that opportunity to like build those relationships, work those clubs. And that's pretty unbelievably cool to have been able to be like a lifer amongst it all.
I know.
And, you know,
man,
so many people drop out, so many people disappear, but we're the ones that can hold on, and you get to know them all and keep performing with them. And I think that's one of the bits about comedy that, you know, if you and I continue with stand up and keep pushing it, sure, we get 10, 15 years that we get to develop a little bit of that relationship wise.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to be there, like, Chappelle's been in it since he was 17.
I know, it's insane. You watch him on his first appearance on Letterman, he looks like he's 19. He might have been.
Unbelievable. He probably was.
And he was doing a lot of the jokes that he started doing in Killing Him Softly or Killing Me Softly.
Really?
But it was interesting because they were clumsy. They were a little all over the place. You could see how he really honed that just for his special. Like, the jokes weren't as tight. They're a little rambly, a little stumbly. And then by the time he gets to his special, that shit is legit.
Yeah. Well, he's brave.
He is.
I mean, he's worked the toughest areas, the hardest clubs. He used to do the street performing shit.
That's right,
just
man.
Take the microphone and go. I mean, it builds such a thick skin, and you get to play in so many angles. I mean, I couldn't have more respect for how he's done his comedy. And when people, yep. like, yeah, he's a genius, right? He's obviously genius. One of those guys that was probably always going to be very, very funny.
It's true.
But he also was incredibly brave. And those two things aren't related a lot of times. Right. He just fucking went for it.
Yep.
And starting that young, I mean, now he's so bulletproof.
Completely. I mean, think he's,
it would be like having four PhDs or like a fifth degree black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Exactly.
I don't know what it's like when you've done something for 35 years at pretty much the highest level.
Top of your game, damn near from the beginning. That's just
Dude,
like...
he was in...
That's insane.
Men in Tights, the Mel Brooks... It's the
first time I ever saw him, and I thought he was hysterical.
He was a teenager.
You combine Mel Brooks and Dave Chappelle. Oh, my God. I remember laughing so hard I cried at that movie.
that movie is fucking ridiculous.
Oh, it's so good. So good. Mm. And I think the...
So the big talk is,
yeah.
when is Rogan on... I mean, when is Chappelle on Rogan?
Oh,
it's got to be soon.
I can't wait.
Everyone that is a fan is talking about it.
It's
got to be close.
That'll be fantastic because Joe isn't like some guy on CNN asking bullshit questions. They'll get into the nitty gritty of a lot of shit, and that'll be a really interesting conversation. Did you watch Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Chappelle?
I don't think I.
It was okay.
Seen that one. You know, I haven't seen many of those. I need to watch.
It was okay. It was okay. Joe will be but that was more like. And it was two colleagues that respect each other, but they're not close. And they're having a little bit of a conversation about their industry. But I feel like he and Joe, I feel like they're boys. That's going to be really interesting. That one I cannot wait
for. Yeah, well, you know, they're definitely close to have gone on this tour recently. And that is a bit of what I do think about that show. No disrespect to it, because it's a great show. And I love cars, and I love comedy, and I love seeing a lot of those guests on there. But you do... notice the ones that Jerry's close to. He's close to Ricky Gervais, right? Or at least he knows him because
Gervais worships
Ricky's
him.
Often in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you've got Louis C.K., who has worked with Seinfeld quite a bit, and Seinfeld showed up on his show.
Right.
So, you know, and Jimmy Fallon. So those episodes were closer, more jokey, and more friendly.
Right.
But then you have that episode that he did with Barack Obama.
Yeah.
That was really quite awkward as fuck.
It was very awkward.
And it's kind of the same way with the other comedians that you must assume Jerry's not that close to.
Yeah,
so it just kind of makes it
Jerry's
a bit weird.
Jerry's an awkward dude anyway. I mean, I think he even admitted that he's on the spectrum or very close to being on the spectrum or something of that sort. And he's kind of an awkward – he's an awkward dude. He has awkward encounters and – I feel like he's so incredibly intelligent, so smart. So I think he has trouble relating sometimes to people that aren't quite on that level too. I mean, because I don't think he finds other people all that interesting. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
I believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He kind of has, not that he comes across as smug.
No.
But he definitely is paying a lot of attention. And he's not very interested
exactly
with what a lot of people
say. A lot of times it reminds me of like Letterman when the Kardashians would come on. And you knew Letterman hated this. Just fucking hated every moment of it. And so, I mean, he was generally respectful. But there were always these subtle hints of like, I don't like you. I find you worthless. You know what I mean? I don't think Jerry does that. But I think there's definitely a bit of like, this isn't going to be my favorite guest. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Did you watch the recent one with Eddie Murphy?
No, I need to. Was that good?
That's the big one. And then, I haven't seen it. I've just seen clips. And then they talk about, but I mean, it's getting a lot of press because I think that was the first time that he was like, I'm going to get back
into
stand-up.
That's when he said I'm getting back into it, yeah.
I think maybe it was Seinfeld that got him in touch with the Netflix people. I think Seinfeld somehow was involved in kind of setting this up.
And it's amazing.
That's where that huge $70 million deal came along. That's phenomenal. But I'd like to see it. I'd like to see that one just to kind of see where his head's at, what it takes to bring it back. It's kind
of
unprecedented.
Yeah.
What do you think about – do you think that Joe is pissed that he hasn't been invited on that show? Because a lot of his friends have.
That's a good question.
A lot of the New York guys have.
That's a really good question. I bet there's a hint of, I don't want to, maybe not.
Like, am I not respected?
Yeah, maybe type thing. And I'm going to be honest, maybe that is the reason. Maybe Jerry doesn't think as much of him as a comic. I mean, you never know. He didn't do it the traditional way that a lot of guys did, especially when Jerry was coming up. His comedy is incredibly different from Jerry's. He's much more of an abrasive comic. Very blue collar. Jerry's not. I'm wondering if there's just a little culture clash there, maybe. But he should be on there because he's a goddamn influential comic. Influential human being.
Yeah. But again, Jerry is the one that gets to hang out with him. It's Jerry's show, so Jerry chooses. I mean, probably the same for Rogan.
Absolutely.
Rogan doesn't want guests on that he's not interested in talking to.
Yeah, why would you?
That would be interesting, though, because you know then that Jerry would go on Joe's podcast. And 3 hours of Jerry, I think we really would find... It would be interesting, because... You only get snippets. I think the longest interview I ever saw with him is... who was that old fucking guy that used to do the interviews? Like, old as shit, and he's super boring.
Larry King.
Larry King, yeah. No, sorry. I guess I've insulted. Yeah, definitely. Is he alive?
Doesn't matter. He's still alive. But, he's still kicking.
All right, right.
On his ninth wife,
so Seinfeld probably. Was on that.
Yeah.
And he was just like, well, wait, you know, what about this when your show was canceled? And Jerry was like, are you fucking kidding me? My show wasn't canceled.
Yeah, I know.
It was a dub.
Yeah, that was on... Well, that was on Larry. That wasn't Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. That was a... No.
Okay, that was on Larry's show. And that was long enough for, like... That was an interview that was long. You know, yeah. where it wasn't Jerry coming up with the questions.
No, I actually liked the old Larry King show when he had interesting guests because they would talk. Same vein, different type of show entirely. The Graham Norton show. I love that because the guests stay on the entire time. So it's not just 5 minutes and they're out and then a musical guest and a bunch of stupid bits. It's like you talk to these guys and you get to hear interesting stories and you get to see them do things that they don't normally do. I really appreciate that. I like I don't know.
And there's no better platform than Joe's 3 hour
goddamn podcast.
Sat there, like, if you want to know who someone is, I mean, it's you're going to be hard pressed to hide who you are that whole time.
100%.
Joe gets people talk. Sometimes people are pretty defensive, but I think we get a lot out of Seinfeld to be on that. But regardless of Seinfeld being on, we got to get Chappelle on.
Oh, dude,
that's going to be epic.
Oh,
I cannot wait.
I cannot wait.
And this is kind of the build up to it. This is two good comedic guests. It was nice to get to know both of them. I think of the two, I enjoyed Whitney Cummings the most.
Yeah.
Just because she's so smart and she takes things in different directions and she has this really interesting way of kind of breaking stuff down. But she's a bit more comfortable on the podcast. I think Brian hadn't been on before, so
sure. It
was a little bit of like starstruckedness.
I get it.
When that happens, Joe ends up talking most of the time,
right?
I think just to ease him in.
He does.
But we're gonna have a good couple of weeks.
Can't wait. I just want
to give a shout out to everyone listening. Thank you so much, as always, for downloading. We're gonna keep bringing you these and keep making them, you know, as best as we can. Follow us on Instagram. Joe Rogan Experience Review. There's like another review one on there for some guys out of Canada. We're the American version of the review.
And the original version.
The oldest review.
Yeah.
The original review. I think we've done 170 episodes.
Woo!
I've done a fuck ton.
I've done about 8.
So we're going to keep them coming. Good job. Good job, Mark. It add up quick.
I know it will.
That's it. So thank you, buddy.
You got it, baby.
All right, cheers. Bye.